Okay.
And a lawyer.
Okay.
So I wanted to know, when you graduated, what was your first position?
Well, when I graduated, my first position was washing dishes at a Jack and Jill fast food restaurant at the 5th Street in Chicago.
What?
I ran an ad for $2 in the Chicago Daily News, which was an afternoon daily paper at the time. Two or three lines, picking bar, waiting bar results. A man by the name of Earl Trulick, T-R-U-L-I-C-K, Earl Trulick, called me soon to the ad that I ran in the paper. And I went to see him at this Jack and Jill fast food restaurant on East 55th Street, east of Cottage in Chicago. I walked in the door. He was sitting on a stool in the restaurant, saw me come in. And at that time, that area of the city was all white. I identified myself to him, and he, sorry, assumed that you were white. That although I have no bigotry or prejudice, you have a business and I have to protect it. And I wanted you to run, to be a manager of the place, because I don't have anybody to help me. I'm afraid the community is not willing to accept black, he didn't use the word black at that time, because black at that time was offensive to us. Colored. Community is not acceptable to colored being in a managerial position. I said, I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. And sit down and order some food, which I did. Ate, and we shook hands. I left. I got back home. Alzada said to me, Mr. Trulick has called since you left. He wants you to come back. I said to him, hell, I don't have confidence of people running back and forth over there. I said, but you better go back, because he said he's reconsidering his position. So I went back. He said, my conscience won't let me do it. He said, I need help. You need a job. He said, if you are willing to work your way into the community, gradually to the point where they would accept you and give me an opportunity to see if you would be accepted by the community, I'd give you a job in the kitchen, doing what, washing dishes. I need a job. It's a job. And I went to work at 6 o'clock. And when I went to Springfield, Illinois, to be sworn in as a lawyer, 2008, I had to bum a ride to get down there. I had to get off from Trulick's job to go down to be sworn in. I was even unaware that there were jobs such as clerks with judges. We were not interviewed by the law firms. Jobs. They didn't even talk to us. One of the ways that I'm ahead of myself going backwards now, the housing accommodation for the law school was Abbott Hall, but from the law school, it's on Superior, cafeteria, and the housing accommodation for the students, medical students, as well as dental students, business students, live there. And what I would do, lunchtime could come, I would go sit out on a bench in front of law school. These students, my classmates would come out, I'd just get up and start with them, they'd go to Abbott Hall. Now, I'm sure when I got in the cafeteria, I'm in the front of the line. By the cashier out to do this, they gonna pay for it. They did. There was a lawyer here, a city named Joseph E. Clayton Jr., very, very prominent lawyer, black. He officed at 3518 South State Street. Somebody told me about him, and I went to see him. He did live, missing him. And finally, I caught him Sunday afternoon in August. I told him I wouldn't work for him. I would be very little value to him. But whatever I did for him, what I'd ask him to do would be to give me car fare if it's spent in going any place on his business. I'd do better than that. I'd pay you $20 a week. Trulick could pay me $50, so I'm making $70 a week, man. So I went to work for Clayton, married to Edith Sampson, who was the first black alternate delegate to the United Nations. Office was over on the second floor over the office of Congressman Dawson. Dawson was William Dawson, was a black congressman from the 1st Congressional District here in Chicago. Clayton was also a Northwestern University Law School graduate. And if my memory serves me correctly, graduated in 36. A very, very brilliant lawyer and a good person. And when he hired me, my job, according to our agreement, and I was going to take over his horse practice. He was basically a criminal lawyer. And of course, I went to court first day, second day, third day, fourth day. But the fifth day, I came to him and told him, I can't do this. Oh, chief, he called me chief. I felt like a prostitute. Actually, a dishonest experience. At 10 o'clock, I'm standing before a judge. I have of a wife requesting her husband to pay her alimony and child support. Man ain't making but $50 a week, and I'm sitting there asking the judge to give her 40 or the 50. Next case called, I represent the husband. He's making $1,000 a week. His wife, who's asking for only $20 a week for support, I'm opposing it because that's too much. It's an intellectual contradiction. I don't like it. He laughed. I said, I'd go to law school to do this. He said, well, chief, you can come go with me from now on. It's like I said it. I signed his horse practice to somebody else, and I started going to 26 in California with him. In the day, attended cases, tried cases, he tried them. Finally, he said to me, what do you make over Trulix? By this time at Trulix, I had become the manager. Incidentally, the boy who took my job in the kitchen was a boy who was in law school, who became a lawyer, became an airline pilot, and got killed in an airline crash. I told Clayton he's paying me $50 a week. He said, well, I'll pay you $50. Leave that job, you come work for me. $70 a week now, Jesus Christ. I go to the office at 9, back to the office, interview clients, do his research in brief writing. Most beneficial experience that I had in the practice was brief writing. I did that. I worked with him for 51 to 55. Went out on my own, office at 12 West Garfield. And the advantage that I had when I went out on my own was I had the experience working with him. Very, very generous person, outstanding person, and extremely brilliant. As a matter of fact, I saw him cross-examine a witness 2 days on his name. Days, the jury ate it up. And had so many aliases, he didn't know what his name was. But anyway, I acquired basic attitudes and philosophies about the law and my duties as a lawyer. In my practice, I never had a client to sign a contract. I'd get on a fee, we'd shake hands. If it was owed me, I'd be a millionaire today. I never filed a lawsuit against a client for not paying. I never refused to represent a client because the client couldn't pay. The concept we have in the profession now is lawyers charge by the hour, $4 an hour, $500 an hour. If I told a client I want $400 an hour, he said, I mean, I was going to take two. Back in those days, there were about 35 or 40 judges on the bench at the time. We knew them all by name, where they lived, where they practiced law. 500 judges now. Legal profession, the criminal practice, the prison practice is probably the fastest growth industry in America today. The practicing law, that was one division of the county department, Cook County Department. When I started practicing law, there were about 1,000 inmates in jail over there, and what they got over there, about something like 15,000 now. That's your next question.
Probably. Client? Yes, about your clients.
Well, basically, I was in the criminal practice from when I was living on my own, from 55, and I did civil rights. Personal injury in criminal law from 1955 until I went on the bench in 1976. Went as a judge on December 6th, when I went on the bench. Or from 1955 until December 1976, basically, I was civil rights and criminal law. I had some. Hey, Sidney. Daddy, he's a judge. His daddy was a judge, and his daddy also was a city councilman. I had some very high-profile cases. I won them. Some people would say and have said that it was because of brilliance as a lawyer, and that's not true. They think that. Accurate perception that they have. I attribute my success as a trial lawyer to several things. One, the basic one, which was when I tried a case, I knew the facts. I knew what happened. That's a tremendous advantage when you know what happened. I don't know what it is about me, but there's obviously something about me. And my clients would always tell me what happened. And they tell me the truth. And so I didn't have to waste a lot of my time going out investigating the case. I don't need no damn investigator. Hell, you tell me what happened. You know you were there. I don't need to hire an investigator to go look at the scene. If you were there, if you robbed a bank, tell me what the hell you did. Did you have a 38 or a 45? And I won cases because I knew the facts. Another factor contributing to my success as a lawyer, not only knowing the facts, but Al Zeta was a very, very good 13th juror. I'll always try my case at home first. This, baby, this is what the state says, this is what we say, which she would aid and assist me in formulating a defense or attacking the state's case successfully. For example, knowing what happened, that boy put a gun on him. It was a big blue steel revolver. It was a white automatic steel revolver. Knowing that, I now know to cross-examine him on the gun. And of course, when you get the police reports and you see that he described the gun differently in the police reports than he described it on the witness stand, you make a contradiction of him on that point. Jurors began to question his veracity. If he can't describe the gun, how in the world is he going to identify the defendant? I recall trying a case where 63rd King Drive, elderly man, senior citizen, janitor of a tavern. He went to work about 2 o'clock and the tavern closed. He's standing on the corner of 63rd and King Drive, 1:30 in the morning, waiting to take a bus to go west to Ashland Avenue where he worked. You know, walking down the street, sees him. See how stupid he is. You know, anybody standing on the corner at 1:30 in the morning in Sub-Zero Weather ain't got no money. Any fool would know that. But the defendant walks over to the man with a knife, tells him, "I'll stick you up, take your money." The man backs out into the street, and he hits the bottle on the curb, breaks it, and he backs out in the street, retreating from the robber. And he backs right in front of a car. And as he does so, the defendant is approaching him, trying to take his money. And driving the car is a policeman. Breaks and runs, cops catches him. Rest found out for the robbery. The man says, the victim, he took $500 from me, which he didn't. I know, you may not know, but I know ain't no man going to be standing on no street corner 63rd and Cottage Grove, King Drive's $500 pocket 1:30 in the morning. That ain't going to happen, period. That ain't going to happen. I didn't get no money from the man. Before I could get the man, the man stopped, the cop jumped out of the car and chased me. So I now know to cross-examine the man about the money. What you doing, $500 in your pocket, 1 o'clock in the morning? Well, I'm heard to him. Pay a bill. Damn bill, you're going to pay 1 o'clock in the morning. By the time I got through, the jury was laughing at him. His officer had to testify that when he caught the man, he didn't have the money. And he says he saw him from the time he broke and ran. The boy said, "I ran because he hollered and screamed. I'm running because the jury quit him." Those are little things that happen during the trial of a case that enables you to win a case. I was fortunate. I recognized, and still do for that matter, that the jury system, derivative of hundreds of years of political oppression, and the jury system came about because of the distrust that litigants had developed for judges. You know that? King appointed judges. And the judges served at the pleasure of the king. And the king decided and determined the compensation of the judges. You can see how that would ultimately lead to a tremendous amount of abuse by are the judges. They're more concerned about satisfying the king than they are about satisfying the litigants. You can see that, of course. They're more concerned about making the Sabbath, staying on the bench, than they would be about doing justice. And as a result, over centuries or decades of abuse and met, demonstrated, sent the king a message that we don't want to be accused of treason, don't want to be accused of being disloyal to the crown, but we are not receiving justice in your courts because your kings are beholden, your judges are beholden to you, king, rather than beholden to us. Sent the message, we are loyal subjects, we give our tax dollars to the crown to support the government, we fight in battle for the crown, we give our lives, we want justice in your courtroom, and the king, agreeing that the time was, that their complaint was valid, decided to allow the litigants to be tried by juries and peers. Find that embodied, I think it's the 38th chapter of the Magna Carta, signed on June 15th, 1215 by King John. And it's by and large the only area in our government that's gone unchanged for over 700 years. And that old got to be good. You know what they're doing. I respect juries, I respect the system. I've been fortunate.
I know you went before the Supreme Court for a couple of cases. I know you went before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, you know, three times.
Could you tell us about those cases?
The first one involved a boy who was arrested on the South Side, and some dope was taken off of him, and we went there on search and seizure grounds. I can't even think of the name of the defendant. I never saw him, tell you the truth about it. I took the appeal from a lawyer named Sam Adams. Oral argument was quite an experience. The Supreme Court adjourns at 12:30. You're in the middle of the man, 12:30, you cut it off. You got to come back the next day. Finish your argument. This is in the 60s. I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember the name of the defendant. When we received notice that the court had granted certiorari and was going to hear the case, and got a date for it, I notified everybody in my family from Alabama, Tennessee. My brother lived in Tennessee with his wife, three children. Aunt lived here in Chicago, and she had two of my cousins, old law partners. I guess we had 25 people in Washington to hear me argue this case. And they stayed in, we stayed in the Watergate Hotel expense. And I'm number four. One's here, two, three, four. And as one finishes, two moves up. Finally got to me, number four. I look around. Everybody in the courtroom looked but Al Zeta. All my kin folks gone. So I argued the case, and at 12:30, I had about five more minutes, so it cut me off. We got to stay overnight, come back and finish the 5 minutes the next day. But where my folks had gone was, there was a congressman named Adam Clayton Powell from New York. He was dating a woman by the name of Josephine Baker, who was a very noted vocalist from Paris. He was dating her down in the Caribbean at Bikini Island, down there somewhere, it's a resort. And he was a Baptist preacher out of New York, out of Harlem. And they went to the Capitol, to the Congress, to participate in a demonstration supporting Adam Clayton Powell and the criticisms that were being leveled against him about being down in the islands with this woman. Well, during the oral argument, Justice Hugo Black from Alabama asked me a question. I don't recall what the question was. I said to him, yes, Your Honor, I never did get back to answer it. I ruled against it 5-4. And had I answered the question, it would have been 5-4 in our favor. That's fate. Now, the next time was in 19... Democratic Party successfully ran Washington Party candidates on the ballot. And we took it to court here, appellate court, at the Supreme Court, United Party versus somebody, I forget who the clerk. And they came back. They still didn't give us what we wanted. We had to go back to Supreme Court. And Supreme Court ruled our favor a second time in the Washington Party case. Quite an experience. It is only one case out of, what, three times. I was known and still am known. I was in practice. I'd appeal a case in a minute. That's how you keep judges in check. All the appeals I've made, I've had them briefs and opinions bound in Naugahyde. I have them in my house, in the library. And I don't think I got paid for 10 of them. I would, if my client was mistreated or did not get justice, I'd appeal. The Justice Appellate Court. For a review. What's your next question?
76. 76. Can you
talk? Elected. I was elected. I wanted to be a judge as much as I wanted to go to the moon on a kite. What happened was this. There had been several judicial scandals. I don't recall what the scandals were. I received a call, I guess about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. I identified himself as Ed Daly's chief of staff, one of his attaches, who it was at the time. Mentioned, we want to slate you as a judge. The old man, meaning Daly, says that it will help the party if you would get on the ticket because it'll give the ticket some stability and some integrity. Of course, you have a reputation out here being a good, honest, hardworking lawyer and person. Thanks. No thanks. I'm not interested. So think about it and I get back to you. I say, well, I will. I be so rude as to say no, but I'm saying no. I really am not interested. But you can get back to me. But I don't want it. No. Started cook, crawling back under the cover. Elzada said, honey, let's talk. Let's talk about what? She said, I heard the conversation. Just so. She said, well, listen to me. You have always insisted, she said, that if everybody's going west, you're the only one going east. Don't stop going east and turn around and go west just because everybody else is going west, which is true. At least you stop going east and ask everybody why y'all going west, why y'all going east, and then you decide whether you want to turn and go west or whether you want to continue to go east or whether you want to stop. And that makes sense. She said, you've always said that. I said, what the hell has got to do with me being a judge? She said, well, there are 45,000 lawyers in this city who would give their right arm to get the call you just got. They're all going west. You're the only one going east. Now, why is it that you don't want to go west and they going west, you going east? It's just a matter of choice. She said, no, it's more than that, honey. She said, 45,000 lawyers can't be wrong and you right. I said, I don't know what it is about it, but you're going to be a judge. She said, no, I don't want to be a judge. Well, think about it. She said, I'm going to talk to you about it further. Said, fine. Next morning, I got up and went to court. Richard Fitzgerald was a presiding judge. I shall never forget it. He sat on the fourth floor of 26 in California. The caller had said to me, this call is confidential. Nobody doesn't know about this call but me and you. When I opened the door going into criminal court, into his courtroom, Fitzgerald was on the bench. Dean, come up here, come up here, come up here. Come on back here. He got off the bench and went, but come on back. He said, I understand the old man called you last night and told you wanted to be a judge and you told him no. I said, I thought the damn conversation was confidential. He said, remember, this is true. He said, there's no such thing as confidentiality in a democratic society. Two people know it, three people know it. I found that to be true. He said, but you can't turn down the highest political office holder in the world, offer you something like this. You can't do that. I said, I just did. He said, but you did wrong. Well, I don't want to be a judge. He said, well, think about it. Think about it. We need you on the ballot. Okay. This is before him. And I left room 400, went to 704. 26 in California. To this day, I do not remember the judge who was there. I can't remember. Been 26 in California?
No.
Oh, four, top floor. Open the courtroom door. Judge on the bench. Bench him! Come up here! Come up here! Come up here! Come up here! Come on back here! Where do you think you are? He said. He said, damn it, the old man called you last night and said he wants you on the judicial ticket. You said no. Who the hell do you think you are? I said, well, I thought I had an option. He said, no, you don't. I said, how did you find out about it? He said, don't worry about it. He said, you're going to be a judge. He said, get on the ticket, get elected. If you don't like it, you can serve the 10, 6 years and go back. Oh, you can retire, resign. You don't have to do it. He said, but get on it. Think about it. I went back home that evening and told Alzada what had happened. She recently got the phone. She said, tell the man you're going to be a judge. I said, you feel that strongly about it? She said, yes. Not only that, but you have a chance now. Time to write your book. Bad idea. So I got on the phone, called and told her. Slated. Affected. Enjoyed the campaign. Enjoyed running. And to a certain extent, I enjoyed being a judge. Not like I enjoyed practicing law, being an advocate. Found the 26th of California. Sat there from December the 7th, 1976 to July the 14th, 1984. Appointed to the appellate court of the Illinois Supreme Court. I was elected to the appellate court in the 1986 election. Served there until 1990 when I retired, resigned to run for President Cook County Board. Appellate court?
Yes.
All of them. All appeals, all trial courts in Cook County came to the appellate court, first district, criminal and civil. Except capital cases. The only case we didn't hear, civil and criminal, was a capital case. By constitution, all capital cases went to the Illinois Supreme Court directly. I sat in the appellate court from 1984 to 1990. I was in the circuit court from 1976 to 1984.
What type of cases?
Cases, criminal cases. I was assigned a criminal division.
Did you have choice in that, or were you appointed?
I had a choice.
Okay.
I'd be an American. I didn't have to take the job. No, I could have sat in the civil division, but I didn't want to sit in the civil division. I sat in the criminal division.
What's the atmosphere like?
The atmosphere?
Yes, with other judges.
I enjoyed it. It was nice. It was not as large then as it is now. How can I put it? I don't want to sound arrogant or pompous, offensive, but I knew what I was doing because I'd been in the profession all these years. I knew how to do what I was doing, and I knew to be the ultimate say-so in the court, and I was the ultimate say-so in the court. To put it more bluntly, to put it like in the hood, I ran it. It was a pleasant experience. Not as comforting or rewarding as the practice of the law, but.
Do you view the law as a judge differently than as a lawyer?
Different as a judge and a lawyer?
Yes.
I recognize the difference in the role I was playing. And one of the problems we have today in the profession is judges don't do that. I recognized when I became a judge that I was no longer a defense attorney. I recognized that as a judge, my role was different. I recognized that as a judge, I was like the umpire, calling the state umpire at the World Series. I cannot be concerned about who wins or loses. I have to call it ball or strike. Unfortunately, now too many judges come on the bench and bring their biases and their prejudices with them from their careers as lawyers, as professors. I don't think I did. I tried not to. The role of the lawyer is an advocate. The role of a judge is a judge. Not the same. I tried to be kind, courteous, stern, sympathetic. I was reversed as a judge only once. It wasn't my fault. Rose because of what the state attorney. Not a perfect system. It has its imperfections. That's why you have an appellate court. I enjoyed it. One is an advocate, one is a judge. One, you're at bat for the Red Sox World Series, the other, you're the umpire of the World Series game. Two are not the same. One role to the next role.
You stepped down from the bench in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a reason you retired?
What happened was this. The Cook County Board is one of the most powerful political offices in the state of Illinois. And it derives its power out of the reality that it controls the budget of 12 constitutional, elective, political county offices. And I don't need to remind you that when you control the money, you control the office. That's just it. President of the Cook County Board, by tradition and custom, came to that position from chairman of the Finance Committee of the Cook County Board. George Dunn was president of the Cook County Board, and he came to that position from chairman of the Finance Committee of the County Board. Seymour Simon, who had previously been on the County Board, president, came to that position from chairman of the Finance Committee, and he ultimately ended up being an Illinois Supreme Court Justice. Richard Overby, who ultimately became governor of the state of Illinois, was also president of the Cook County Board and came to that position from chairman of the Finance Committee. George Dunn, who was a very high-ranking official in the Democratic Party, decided that he would not seek retention for the president of the Cook County Board. At that time, the chairman of the Finance Committee was a black man by the name of John Strocher. The party refused to slate John Strocher, slated instead Ted Litkowitz. The party said that John could not win beyond the geographical boundaries of where black people live, which was another polite way of saying that white folks won't vote for a black candidate. We met August of 1989 up until the last moment, trying to get a black public official to run for president of the board against Litkowitz. Day one would say yes, next day he'd say no. I did not then realize that the black political office holders were reluctant to run because they did not want to incur the wrath of the Democratic Party power structure. So if we chose one today and he'd come back the next day and say, no, I won't take it, and then what we choose? Finally, we didn't have anybody to run. And Al Zeta and I talked about it, and we said, we're not going to take this up. I had written more dissenting opinions. 6 years I was on the appellate court. All of the judges combined in the entire history of that court, I was bored, dining, and she said, this again would give you a chance to perhaps write something on your book, because you haven't written the first word yet. So I resigned from the bench to run for president of Cook County Board. Boy in the race, Litkowitz, Stanley Cusper, and Palin, and me. I ran for seat on the board as well. I won the nomination for the seat. I lost my nomination for president to Palin. I did not want to sit on the board as a seat, so I gave up that position, gave it to Danny Davis, who at that time was a city councilman. Davis won the seat on the board and ultimately became and is now a congressman. And what happened was, when the votes were in and we looked at the statistics, we found that not only would white people vote for a black candidate, me, in several other ward townships, I won. As a result of that, these statistics, Carol Moser Braun looked at the statistics, and she decided to run against Dixon in the 1992 senatorial primary and beat him in a statewide race, which is really unprecedented. Really unprecedented for black running statewide. White folks voting for black for Senate, that was unheard of. But she won in 1992. In 1994, when Palin's term expired, the party slated Strocher. And Strocher became president of Cook County Board and retained that position until what, just a couple of years ago, when he had a stroke. And now his son's in that position. Well, it completely destroyed the myth. Well, I knew it was a myth in the first place. When I was campaigning, I'd go into all white wards to run up on the board ourselves. And I said, look, I don't see why you're having a reluctance to vote for me. I ain't done nothing to you. You did it to me. Y'all enslaved us. We didn't enslave you. Why are you mad at me? If you can enslave me, my people, my great granddaddy, and I come out here and vote for you, and you enslave him, why can't you vote for me? It's so simple. And you find that when you talk to people frankly, they respond frankly. So as a result of that, Roland Burris ran for Attorney General of the state of Illinois, won. You have a Secretary of State, Jesse White, who's black, Secretary of State, won. And this false myth that the party had been telling black folks that white folks won't vote for black folks is crazy, because they do. You got a black mayor in Atlanta, black mayor in Jackson, Mississippi, black mayor in Birmingham, black mayor in Richmond, Virginia. That's just nonsense. And if they don't, it's time we break the barrier anyway. So here we are. What's your next question?
I know you were a judge when Harold Washington was elected.
Yes.
Were you?
I like that. Harold and I were very good friends. Right. Very good friends. The battle between Vidoliak 29 and Harold was not a racial battle. Political power battle. marijuana ballot because of reapportionment. And the time is rapidly coming to a halt. A racial identity becomes a factor in the elections. I don't think Obama's going to win. I'm going to vote for him. But as you sit here now, but 20 years ago, it would be unthinkable for a woman to be a candidate for president of the United States. It's unthinkable. It just didn't happen. When I was in law school, it's unthinkable that a woman be a lawyer. Discrimination has not only been against blacks, it's been against women. And now you find women on the bench, women running for public office. But it should not be an issue in an election. The sex of the candidate or the race of the candidate shouldn't be an issue. And we get around to it. On one building a day. What's your next question?
The climate today has changed so that there are a lot of black elected officials.
What is happening, and it's a very crucial period, politicians are injecting into the political arena issues that really should not be in the political arena, in my judgment. They disagree with me. For example, I don't think that abortion should be a political issue. I don't think that a candidate should be elected or defeated in an election based upon what his views may be about abortion. And I think that it's being injected into it on the basis of religion when we have attempted, to the extent possible, avoid electing candidates based upon religious issues. That's my thinking. I think the political arena is one involving economics, period. Which party best serves my economical interest, period. What I think about prayer in schools, what I think about abortion, that's my personal business. I mean, I got a damn thing to do with it. But in order to attain or get elected or defeat somebody, these issues are being dragged into the arena, unfortunately, which should not be there. People talk about Hillary, and I'm not going to vote against Hillary because she's Hillary, but I'm just voting for Obama because I think I should vote for Obama. But to suggest that Hillary shouldn't be president because she's a woman is crazy. Or to suggest she shouldn't be president because she forgave Clinton because he had an affair with Lewinsky is idiotic. It's insane. I don't give a damn what you may think. I tell you, you're crazy if you believe that. Who in their right mind would give up the highest paid office in the history of civilization because her husband was guilty of infidelity? That's crazy. If she was, it's her husband, I ain't married to him. If she wouldn't forgive him, why should I hold it against him? I preach my sermon on that. But there are people out here who genuinely, she should have quit Clinton. You got to be crazy to suggest she should. If she was willing to forgive him, certainly it ain't no business of mine, period. And I think, unfortunately, Clinton would have gone down in history as one of the greatest presidents in this country, but for that episode in his life. But he proved, just like anybody else proved, that he's human. All he proved, he's human. What's your next question?
To know about some of the challenges you faced as being a judge.
Challenges?
Yes.
I faced as being a judge?
Yes.
Staying awake on the bench.
Difficult to hear cases in the criminal court system. You see the same people coming in times for minor crimes.
It's painful to see the scene that's going on in the, and there are more black men in the penitentiary than there are in college. Says something about our culture and our society. I'm not suggesting that those who are there shouldn't be there. That's not what I'm saying. What I am suggesting is that whatever caused them to be there, it's a flaw in what caused them to be there, their thinking. I recognize that 95% of people in the penitentiary should have been there 20 years before they got there. There are some who shouldn't be there, but there's no question about that. But it says something about the basic of our society when such a disproportionate number of blacks are in the penitentiary as to whites. The system is flawed, tremendously flawed. What you have in reality are people with a certain moral standard enacting laws based upon their moral standards to govern not themselves, but to govern people who don't have the same moral standards. Are you with me? It ain't gonna work. It will never work. Books say thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. That don't need to be on the book for me. I ain't gonna steal from you no way. I ain't gonna kill you no way. I don't need that on the book. You don't need it on the book. It ain't because it's the law that don't call you to steal. You just a person of a moral fiber that you're not going to do that. Right or wrong? Of course you're right. You're right. You walk in the Marshall Field store, you don't steal because it ain't because you're scared of going to jail. You just have a moral fiber that you don't steal. And you got laws here governing people who don't have the same moral fiber. Well, how do you deal with that? If I knew the answer, my marquee'd be on the moon. I don't know the answer. But I do know that we're doing it working. They're working. And we are unwilling, at least up to this point, we have not taken another approach to it. I sat on the bench. I hadn't sat on the bench for about a month. And I recognized and saw something that I had not seen in the 25 years I practiced law. Over my 25 years of practicing, I'm dealing with case by case by case instead of the masses coming before me at one time. I heard on the average of I had on average 8, 7, 8, maybe 9 defendants who appeared before me daily, charged with the commission of felonies. Common denominator of the defendants was they're usually under 35 years of age. Common denominator was they were black. I don't think I had 5 white defendants appear before me in the 6 years I sat at 26 in California. Common denominator was they're recidivists, they're repeat offenders. Common denominator was they usually come from broken homes. One's going to shock you. Common denominator was in the 6 years I sat there, not a defendant appeared before me to finish high school. And more importantly, not a one had participated in a high school extracurricular activity. It says something, doesn't it? Of course it says something. Of course it says something. In 6 years, not a kid appeared before me to play football. We played basketball. Or he'd played baseball, or he'd been on the swim team, or he'd played track, or he'd played in a band. So what you're saying is those who play football, basketball, baseball, and track, and play in the band don't commit crimes. And that's true. By and large, that's true. And the reason for that is very simple. The thing a child wants to do most when he's going to school is what? He wants to play. And when you take playing away from him, you encourage him to do what? To quit. And ironically, there is no course that you can take, there's no school to which you can go and get a degree on how to be a parent. They don't teach that course. People rear their children like they were reared. If they were reared immoral and stupid and ignorant, that's how they rear their children. Immoral, stupid, and ignorant. We've got to deal with that, and we're not dealing with it. Dropping out of school was just unheard of in my day. It just didn't happen. And where my kids went to Harlan High School, you went to Lane, my kids went to Harlan. We played football over in Lane. Today, they have metal detectors in the front door of the schoolhouse, the police sitting there. You can't get in the school without a kid going through a metal detector. That's horrible. Terrible. We have not lived up to our responsibility to our children. That's terrible. Suppose suppose you had to go to school every day and you wonder whether or not she got a gun on her. When you come out of school, you got to look around and see somebody going to shoot at you. I don't know the answer. I don't know the solution, but I know what we're doing ain't right. I think, and I really genuinely believe this, I genuinely believe that the first thing, if I had anything to do with Chicago Board of Education, would be I would insist upon extracurricular activity would be mandatory. Mandatory. Something else, I tell you. Watch it. A kid can go to school in Chicago with a perfect attendance record for 12 years. Straight A student for 12 years. Never get mentioned. He walk out and shoot somebody, makes headlines. That's an imbalance. Walk guy driving drunk kills somebody, makes headlines. Emphasis put on the wrong place in our culture, in our society. We're not dealing with that. And the financial crunch, you're going to stop kids from playing basketball. That's crazy. And I said, tell you, I'm going to get out of here. It's 1 o'clock.
I remember, well do I remember, dissecting the earthworm in high school. Well do I remember dissecting the frog in the biology lab in high school. I don't remember a damn thing I learned from it, but I remember doing it. I recall most vividly the practice sessions in the afternoon practice football. I remember the admonitions the coach made in football. I don't give a damn whether you agree with the quarterback or not. If the quarterback calls it, run it. Run it. We'll argue about it next week. I learned from that to follow orders. And I'm a football nut. And I know football ain't nothing but discipline violence. That's all it is. It's discipline violence. You knock some bitch down in a certain way, you got to knock him down. You can't knock him down from the back. You know how to get up and don't get back, glad to fight back. I learned more from playing football and baseball about character, morals, leadership, following the leader, loyalty. And those are the ingredients that upon which our society is based and predicated. I'd be the first to say, if you ask me, do you eliminate biology from the classroom or football? I said, take out biology. Eliminate home economics? Or do you eliminate the band? Take out home economics. Our children need discipline. We're not getting it. What else you got? No, I got to go.
I had one more question. Did you ever get to writing your book? Your book? Did you ever get to
write? I ain't wrote the first word yet.
I haven't written the first word yet. As a matter of fact, I was saying this morning when I got up, I got to get to it. I got a story to tell.
Okay.
We look forward to hearing it.
I got a story to tell.
Thank you.
Tell you about some of these cases I tried.
Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
We know it's valuable, and this was
my pleasure.
Very fascinating. Thank
my
you.
My pleasure. I tried a case once. A probation officer involved in a fight with a court clerk. The probation officer was much larger, heavy and bigger. And he had a knife and he cut the clerk across his face. Really shouldn't have done it. I had as much chance of winning that case as I got flying to the moon on a kite. It's true. Tried it right down here in this building. That's when they had some of the criminal cases down here. And I made a motion to exclude the witnesses. And those ordered witnesses excluded. And the clerk got on the stand and was testifying about how the defendant hit him across the face. What clerk indicated to me, I needed to cross-examine the witness door and snatched the door open. And the boy's mother was had her head down the door, fell into the courtroom on the floor, eavesdropping. The judge was furious. He was furious. Mr. Pinchum, you don't have anything else to ask, do you? Say, I don't, Judge. No. Well, you don't have anything else to ask. Mr. Stetson, you got anything else? She's sitting there eavesdropping, I in an order directing. And that's his mother. Be filing or not guilty.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
All right.
Would you like me to...